This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. If there's one absolute truth about Donald Trump, it's that he's radically altered the ways in which we talk about politics. While conversations about politics and ideology have never been particularly civil or uplifting or idealistic, these days they're downright nasty, and especially among groups who are mostly on the same side of things. The narcissism of petty differences has never been a bigger thing than right now in many ways. And this is nowhere more clear than on the Republican-friendly right wing, where the division between pro-Trump and never-Trump conservatives is creating more friction than Stormy Daniels on a stripper's pole. My guest today on The Reason Podcast is one of the most prominent never-Trump conservatives in the country, and he's recently been attacked by fellow right-wingers for, get this, for being too nice a guy. That's a problem in Trump's America. I'm speaking of David French, who's a senior writer for National Review and a columnist for Time Magazine and a book author and many other things. French's conservative bona fides are sterling. He's a devout Christian who writes about how religion is central to living a flourishing life. He's written critically of high levels of immigration. He's resolutely anti-abortion and pro-military intervention and even served in the Iraq War. He believes that young men today are being stripped of their traditional masculine identities by feminism and other forces, and he's written critically of trans people and kind of discussions of trans culture in America today. So what's the problem with David French, and why should his travails be of interest to libertarians? That's the question I want to ask him, as well as getting a sense of what he feels like being attacked by fellow conservatives. So he's being attacked by his fellow right-wingers because he believes in the classical liberal idea of a marketplace of ideas where people civilly argue over ideas and agree to abide peacefully by the outcomes of elections. That's a terrible thought, isn't it? He mostly believes in the power of persuasion rather than coercion, and he's a resolute civil libertarian who remains very skeptical of government power, even or maybe especially when his own side is wielding it. We're going to talk about all that and also about a recent court decision finding Oberlin College guilty of compensatory damages for defamation, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and intentional interference with business relationships in connection to statements its students and officials made in relation to a local bakery in Ohio. French is also the former president of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, the nation's premier outfit fighting for free expression on college campuses, and he thinks the Oberlin verdict may be a turning point when it comes to political correctness in higher education. So we're going to talk about that. But first, David French, thanks for talking to Reason.
Well, thanks for having me. I've listened to the podcast many times. It's an honor to be on.
All right. Well, thanks. Let's change that opinion by the end of this conversation. So in the pages of First Things, which is, I think a lot of our listeners know what it is, but it's a small but influential journal of conservative opinion that has a kind of Catholic heritage. The op-ed editor of the New York Post, a guy named Sohrab Amari, launched an attack that was literally titled Against David Frenchism. And he says, you embody everything that is weak and wrong with contemporary conservatism. Can you summarize his argument against you?
Yeah, it's a lot of people have tried to make it something other than what it actually was. And what it actually was an argument that had three main components. One is the assertion that politics today is better described as war and enmity. That's the phrase that he used, war and enmity. In those circumstances, civility and decency are what he would call second order values. They're optional and sometimes undesirable. But the big idea of it was that classical liberalism, small L liberalism itself, not only is inadequate to meet the challenge of the illiberal left, but that classical liberalism leads to societal decay, that classical liberalism is itself a problem.
So it's almost like an inverse of a kind of Herbert Marcuse's idea of repressive tolerance, which, in the 60s, Marcuse said that, when in an American society that needed to be overthrown because it was fundamentally unjust, the idea that you could have demonstrations and you could engage in debate was a way of kind of releasing the steam that would build up to revolution.
Right.
Amari is kind of saying that, you know, this belief in liberal values of rational discourse and civil discourse and open idea discussion of ideas, that's just going to lead to what we have now, which
right.
is horrible.
Which is horrible. And, you know, his number one exhibit or his exhibit A of the horror of American life was something he'd actually brought up a few days earlier, this drag queen reading hour right. in Sacramento Public Library. And this whole thing started a few days earlier when I'm minding my own business on Memorial Day weekend when he, by tweet, points out the existence of this drag queen reading hour and then says there's no polite David Frenchian way through this. And so essentially, his argument is that my fundamental sin is in believing that coexistence is possible mm-hmm. Or that coexistence can be even healthy for society. His view is you fight through the culture war to win and enjoy the spoils, whatever that means.
And I mean, to be clear, it's not clear what he meant, right? Like, because what would it mean to stop the drag queen reading hour?
Well, or that's what one of my big questions, because, you know, this is a local library. This is a Sacramento City library, so far as I know. Do you want to federalize the libraries to stop drag queen reading hour? Wouldn't that have a whole lot of consequences? Do you want to interfere with the freedom of association rights of the parents who are sending their kids to drag queen reading hour? It seems to me that has a lot of problematic consequences.
So he's arguing, I mean, essentially that, you know, in a just society or in a more righteous American society, the local people, I assume, or the people who ran the library would have said to the drag queens or to the, you know, whatever group it was, like, no, you're not welcome here because the way that you present yourself is at odds with what we know to be
the higher good.
A good, yeah.
Right.
Okay. So, and let me, you know, and because I also don't want to, I think that you and I fundamentally agree on a kind of large framework of how people should act in society. And then the individual choices people make will be different.
Right.
You're not a fan. You're not going to send your kids to the drag queen reading hour.
No, okay. No. I'm not sending my children to drag queen reading hour. I think, I'm not quite sure how this became the stand-in.
Yeah.
But I think—
But it is really important because, you know, the $22 trillion in debt, you know, ongoing war, disasters and, you know, all, you know, Iran might have fired on American ships. Like, what's really important is what's happening in Sacramento Public Libraries.
But it's symbolic of the area of the culture war in which cultural conservatives, social conservatives feel most embattled is
yeah.
in the sexual revolution.
Right.
And so that's an area that's symbolic of sort of the argument from cultural catastrophe.
Right.
Because his argument depends on a sense of cultural catastrophe.
I want to get to that question of cultural catastrophe and where you stand on whether or not that's real or not. But first, you know, and you mentioned Memorial Day weekend, you know, you're just trying to get on with your life, you're trying to take a couple days off and you're being attacked by a fellow conservative. A couple of years ago, there was a different Memorial Day weekend that kind of got screwed up because that was
yes.
when Bill, well, I want to talk about that, when Bill Kristol was like, ladies and gentlemen, I have a secret weapon. A person who is going to win the presidency away from Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And, of course, that was you. And we'll get to that in a second. But what's it feel like to be called out by name? Because it's not simply even saying, you know, David French is wrong here. It's like
right.
no, David Frenchism is the problem.
Right.
You are the cancer,
right?
You know,
well,
on the swollen liver of contemporary conservatism.
The Frenchism aspect of that was completely new. Yeah. The calling out by name, unfortunately, was old hat
right.
at this point. I mean, for whatever reason, well, and partly due to Memorial Day 2016,
yeah.
I've become a favorite target of, you know, in this sort of extremely insular online Twitter world, I've become a favorite target of sort of the MAGA right because a couple of reasons make me a different target from, say, other conservatives who've received a lot of slack, who've maybe migrated more to the left, like a Max Boot
uh-huh.
or Jen Rubin, Tom Nichols, and
right.
some of these
yeah,
other
yeah.
folks who are on all
well,
these
Well, and they're
wars.
Never Trumpers, but they have also said, I'm done with the right. I'm no
I'm
longer
just
a conservative.
Done with it, right.
Yeah.
So I'm still a pro-life, religious mm-hmm. liberty, conservative, the same basic political positions and ideology and worldview that I had. And people of my particular persuasion, both religious and political, are falling into the Donald Trump camp left and right. And so I think there's sort of this particular anger and also...
What are they angry about then in that sense? Because, you know, what, and I realize like Trump can never not be angry. The more he wins, and I don't know that he's delivered on, you know, his statement that we would be winning so much we would be sick of winning, but he's, you know, he's doing pretty well in many ways. What is that anger? Like, you know, where is it coming from?
Well, I think it's two things. One, just simply put, a lot of elements of the MAGA right imitate the leader, and they imitate his style, and they believe that his style and the way he approaches politics is a key to victory. And it's also a key to success, and it's a key to advancement within the broader conservative movement. I mean, you know, if you're going to watch the Fox primetime lineup, you're going to see people are sort of outdoing each other with how much they're, you know— their pugilistic style, how much they're name calling people out by name, how much they're angry and aggressive. And so this sort of style, which didn't originate with Trump, but he took to a new level. So that fundamental style that this is the way we're going to do combat, political combat, is permeating the right. So that's number one. And then number two, a lot of people are mad at the arguments that I make because I tend to make or often make moral arguments. Mm-hmm. So I won't say... I will say, you know, on a policy basis, I think this policy is a mistake because of this or that consequence. But I also say things like, you know, Franklin Graham is being hypocritical and that's wrong.
So, and Franklin Graham is the son of Billy Graham.
Right.
And he's in a piece that you read that I thought was stunning. And this obviously, you know, drives pro-Trump or MAGA people insane that back in the day, Franklin Graham was saying, you know, that Bill Clinton's personal life was absolutely, a proper topic of impeachment, of public call-outs and all of that. But now the same people are saying Trump's personal life is like, come on, that's his personal life. It doesn't matter. It has no bearing whatsoever on anything.
Right. I mean, in 1998, Franklin Graham writes in the Wall Street Journal where he says, if you're going to lie to your wife and daughter, what will you not lie about to the American people? Which I thought was a completely fair criticism. In 1998, the Southern Baptist Convention drafts a statement of moral character for public officials where it talks about how toleration of serious wrong by public officials sears the conscience of a culture. Fast forward to 2018, he says, oh, that was all a mistake.
Yeah.
The Stormy Daniels business is nobody's business but, you know, Trump's. And then in 2019, he tweets in opposition to Pete Buttigieg's same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. And so what was the only real constant here? The only real constant is he was opposing the Democrat and supporting the Republican.
Do you, and I mean, I assume you define yourself first, you know, first as a Christian, but then also as a conservative, et cetera. And so that principle before party matters.
Well, yeah, there. You know, to me, this is not a hard call.
Yeah,
you know?
And I guess technically you tweeted, I think it was a tweet last fall, that you are no longer a Republican.
No,
you
I don't consider myself a Republican.
And by that, it doesn't mean you're not going to vote for Republicans.
Right.
It's just you had been a card-carrying member of the Republican Party or something.
I mean, in Tennessee, you don't literally carry around a card.
Okay.
You decide when you go to the primary polls which party you're
in.
So I've voted Republican for Republicans. I have endorsed Republicans, but I don't consider myself a Republican.
Yeah.
I can't consider myself a Republican.
So
Trump's the head of the party.
Is this just a will to power, basically? It's, you know, that it really has nothing to do with principle. It has everything to do with winning the next, you know, 5 minutes in the news cycle and then hopefully an electoral victory, which may or may not mean anything because this is another thing, you know, from a kind of libertarian perspective who – I'd always looked at the Republican Party, at least in the past, you know, few decades, they were a party of free trade.
Right.
So like they'll win a battle, but yeah, but then the principles are just totally gone.
Well, I think so. I think you have some people who are Machiavellian, some people who, you know, what's happening now is just part of the grift. It's part of the cling to power. But I think for an awful lot more people, and this gets back to the culture war point that we've talked about. People are living in a state of fear now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this essay, the Flight 93 election.
Right. Which, describe that briefly. That was in the Claremont Review of Books, and it was a pretty influential, at least among kind of higher-end circles in conservative thinking.
It put an intellectual frame over the embrace of Trump.
Right.
And essentially what it was arguing is that America is in mortal danger. And Americans are in the position of the passengers of Flight 93, and they have to charge
them. And that's the flight just for, you know, the millions of people who have been born since then. But that was the flight on 9/11 where passengers took control and crashed it into the ground in Pennsylvania rather than have it. It was either going to go to the White House or the Capitol
building,
and crash into it.
Right. And so, you know, it was charge the cockpit or die.
Right.
And
let's
they
roll.
Might die anyway because you don't know what's going to happen with Trump. But you know the plane's going to crash with Hillary. So and that he was not forming a public opinion. He was tapping into a public opinion. And in my days in 2016, when I was opposed to both Trump and Hillary, I would have many conversations with genuinely distraught people who were saying, David, you have to support him or America will be over.
Right. So two things. Who did you vote for in 2016?
I voted for Evan McMullen.
Oh, my gosh. He was your stand-in.
He was
your
the
understudy.
Guy. He was my
Because Bill Kristol had teased on Memorial Day weekend, I've got this great guy. I feel like Tristram Shandy or something going down all of these rabbit holes. But first off, did Bill Kristol get in touch with you to say, hey, you know what, you're the guy and I'm going to – or did you find out when you read it on Twitter?
No, well –
like everyone else.
I had had dinner with Bill a couple of days before all of this happened, and we had talked about the state of the effort to recruit somebody to take on Trump and Hillary. And, you know, all of the big names had said no. Mitt Romney had just foreclosed it. And so, you know, we were lamenting the fact that nobody had stepped forward. And he said, I think our ideal candidate, failing the, you know, considering that the big names had not come forward, is somebody who's outside of politics, from middle America, preferably a post 9/11 veteran. And I just agreed with that in principle. Yeah, sure. You know,
no, you didn't realize that he was pressing the button underneath the table saying, okay, we've got him.
And so the next morning I woke up and my phone was kind of blowing up, and he had written in the Weekly Standard that was the profile, would be somebody like my friend David French.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm not saying he's the ideal person or there are many other people like him. And, you know, later that day, I believe, he said, I know I'm serious about this. Is this something you'd consider? And this is going to sound like I'm the most insane person in the history of the world. But at that time, you know, you're sitting there thinking, and this is before the Republican convention.
Right.
Can somebody do something? And if nobody's going to do anything, should I? And so I spent about 2 to 3 days actually really thinking it through, calling an awful lot of people. And at the end of the day, I realized the absolute maximum possible effect that I could have at just peaking would have been to be the Ralph Nader of 2016, the guy who everyone says, you know, but for you and your meddling ways, you know, one of the major party candidates would have won.
Al Gore would have won.
Al Gore would have won.
Maybe. I don't know. And now you look at it and it's like, yeah, that might not have been such a bad thing. I don't know.
Who knows? But then especially as the Republican establishment just locked in behind Trump. This was also before Paul Ryan had endorsed. This was before, you know, there were a lot of sort of balls still in the air at that point, but it was the right decision not to do it, absolutely. But yeah, it did have the effect, obviously enough, of sort of putting a target on your back from that day
so
forward.
So let's get back to this question of cultural catastrophe, because there's so many ways to talk about that. And you mentioned before that on the kind of religious right or many parts of the conservative right, this idea of catastrophe, of the decline of America, has something to do with the sexual revolution, first and foremost. And do you agree with that? And then what are the contours of that decline?
Yeah. So I would say my thinking on this has changed a little bit over time. Before I started writing full-time for National Review, I was a religious liberty constitutional lawyer. And so what that means is I'm always at the point, the flashpoint.
Right.
So I'm always where the censorship is the worst, where the problems are the worst, which is one of the things that was ironic about the notion that I don't fight. I'd spent my entire career litigating.
Yeah, no. In a response to Amari, you said that you had been accused of milquetoast libertarianism.
Yes.
Which I'm kind of like, oh wow, I'm going to get that on a vanity plate for myself.
And I qualified it with milquetoast because I know enough libertarians to know libertarianism is not milquetoast.
So what were the types of religious liberty cases that you
taking
were
on speech codes on college campuses? So when I was president of FIRE, we had a project to identify what percentage of top universities had speech codes in the U.S. and created a national litigation strategy to try to strike them down.
And those often involve people being denied the groups being denied the ability to kind of talk about religious topics.
Sometimes, yeah. It could be a lot of different things. It's left-wing groups being denied the ability to talk, which does happen actually on campus on occasion. So speech codes, freedom of association, that would be the right of clubs to organize on campus, which does focus – that issue did focus a great deal on Christian groups. Faculty intellectual and academic freedom, one of my last big cases before I joined National Review is I represented a professor in what I think is the first big jury verdict – or first jury verdict on behalf of a conservative professor denied a career opportunity because of his ideology.
So that who was that?
Mike Adams. He he often writes for townhall.com. He's at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And so that was the kind of case. So I'm always there at this flashpoint in the middle of sort of where the illiberal left is at its strongest. So I had a more doom and gloom view of the culture war. As I moved out of doing that exclusively, my view of it changed. And I saw the culture war as a much more mixed bag. I like the way that my colleague Ramesh Panuru has phrased it. He said, over the last generation or two, America has become more pro-gun, pro-life, and pro-gay.
And we had long been taught to believe that these things could not all advance at the same time.
Not possible.
Yeah.
So I found it kind of interesting that the argument was being made once again about the catastrophe, the cultural catastrophe, when more states were passing more pro-life legislation at the same time than literally any time since Roe. That was happening at this same time.
And to be clear, I mean, you see that as a good thing.
I do,
Any kind of restrictions on abortion is to the good.
Yeah. Yes. And so this huge legislative wave is happening at the same time as Drag Queen Reading Hour in Sacramento Public Library. And one of the things that I've been trying to do in my writing is to get people to stop catastrophizing their view of politics and to stop having this Flight 93 mentality. There are things that you win and there are things that you lose, but you don't go to a progressive gathering and hear them say things like, our victory is almost at hand. They are catastrophizing. They are doom and glooming. And one of the things that makes a lot of American culture conversation toxic is that both sides think they are losing.
Well, this is also, I mean, I was about to say, well, that, you know, at least the libertarians are optimistic, and it's like, hell, there are still people who have gold buried in their backyard because they're expecting, you know, the run on the banks to happen at any point in time.
And hey, I'm an amateur prepper.
There is a long tradition. I mean, there's even a school of literary thought that says the Jeremiad is the essential genre of American fiction. I mean, you know, going back to the colonial period. So we've always been doom and gloomers and stuff. Where do you stand then on something like, you know, and this is mixing your conservative values and religious values. I assume you don't agree that it's a proper Christian understanding of kind of theology to allow gays to marry. But then how does that play out in the civil law? Like, should there be marriage equality, though? Should the state treat two individuals equally regardless?
So my view on the same-sex marriage issue was religiously, I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. I do not believe the Constitution of the United States – I'm an originalist in my interpretation of the Constitution. I think an originalist reading of the Constitution saying that the 14th Amendment protects the right of same-sex marriage, I think is I don't see the foundation for that.
Okay.
And legally, my view was that marriage should be defined by the states. And so that was
Which would open up the possibility if a state says, you know, same-sex marriage is okay, then you're fine with that.
Correct. The people of Massachusetts were voting, and the people of Massachusetts decide that same-sex marriage you know, that's up to them and to their community. One of the core aspects of my entire political philosophy is we need to push a lot of these really important questions down much more to the local level.
And then also leave, and I mean, I think this in reading your work, and this, I mean, is, you know, really, I think, central to a almost 17th century understanding of liberal philosophy, or where it began in arguments in England over the right of conscience and whatnot, which is that, you know, what the state does is not, the state doesn't necessarily give a moral imprimatur on everything. So as the real question then, or the where you would go to the barricades, where you would get on the plane and crash it, is if the state then said, your church has to marry anybody that we say is
right. That would be an illiberal imposition on a fundamental right.
Do you, by the way, you mentioned the illiberal left, you know, Amari, a lot of conservatives do. Do you think that the left, whatever that means, is fundamentally illiberal?
No.
Are they? So, yeah. So we're already kind of gaming the system in the same way that many left wingers will say, you know, the right are theocrats, and what they really want to impose as some kind of theocracy that's indistinguishable from what they have in Iran, who we might be actually more amenable towards. So it all gets very complicated very quickly.
You know, one of the things I think we're finding in this age is that left and right is becoming an inadequate way of describing the conversation because there is a liberal left and there is an illiberal left.
Right.
There is a liberal right and there is an illiberal right. And in many ways, the liberal right and the liberal left have more in common than the illiberal. Then, so for example, if you're going to look at some of the viewpoints of the folks at First Things, I might agree with them on an issue or two or three, but on the fundamental structure and framework of what our government is and should be, we're so far apart that I don't consider this an intramural squabble.
Right.
So if you're illiberal, whether you're on the right or on the left, you're I don't consider you on my team. And if you're a liberal committed to sort of small L liberal values, classical liberal values, I feel much more kinship because one of the things I think that is a difference between liberal and illiberalism and liberalism is the reflexive response. If we're going to make an argument about a moral issue in society, one of the illiberal reflexive responses to a moral issue is to once something has been labeled as immoral, the next thought is there ought to be a law.
Right.
There has to be something that the state can do to stamp this out. And you and I might disagree on many moral issues, but one of the last things I'm thinking, unless there's direct harm to another human being as a result of whatever act you're taking, one of the last thoughts I'm having is there ought to be a law.
Right.
I'm thinking there ought to be a conversation.
So it seems as if there ought to be a law is becoming more and more potent. Because a lot of people on the left and a lot of people on the right are no longer saying, you know what, we should be working these out in private arrangements or through persuasion
freedom
or through
association.
Voluntary association. Mm-hmm. Where is that coming from? Why, you know, and it might be, you know, in a lot of ways, the sphere in American life for private action is probably stronger than it's ever been. It's easier to live however you want to. Not with the sanction of the state, but also maybe not getting roused. I mean, you know, within, at least within my lifetime, I mean, you could get in trouble if you were a black man and a white woman living together.
Right.
That was against the law. Now it's not. And
there's
more space for all of that kind of stuff. Where is this sense that we need more laws to govern moral arrangements coming from?
You know, I'm going to go back to the same impulses that are creating the toxic political environment. I mean, there is a will to power that exists, but there is an awful lot of hate and fear at the same time. We are a negatively polarized country, and what that means is your typical Republican is not a Republican because they love Republican ideas, but because they really dislike Democrats. And vice versa, Democrats really, really dislike Republicans. The polling on this is extraordinary, and it's getting worse. And so what ends up happening is both sides tend to look at the law as the shield against the other. And so you'll see the sort of selective embrace of freedom of association.
Right.
The social media context is a perfect example of that. And so conservatives, I think, should object to Twitter's hate speech guidelines as being vague and subjective and arbitrary in the same way that university speech codes are. But Twitter is it's a voluntary association. It's a private corporation. And the very same people who have been walking into the middle of places like, you know, the Cal State system or you know, various universities around the country and saying, preserve voluntary association, or defending the Baker, Jack Phillips, or Baronelle Stutzman and say, defend the rights of conscience, or Hobby Lobby and the ability of a business to have its own religious perspective and values that it advances, are now saying, not for you, Twitter.
Right. Or, you know, Facebook. I mean, I'm amazed when you see people like Ted Cruz, who certainly knows better and talks a good game about being limited government once, you know, unless Facebook makes Diamond and Silk, like the biggest duo, like he wants the government to do something better, to regulate it as a public utility, or kind of, you know, threaten them into some kind of behavior. Where is the fear coming from then? I mean, you mentioned, and it's like, so both the left and the right feel like they're on a precipice and, you know, they're about to get blown off the face of the earth.
Right.
Who, you know, like, where is that coming from?
Well, there are legitimate issues. Like, I don't want to say that questions about religious liberty that are being fought in the Supreme Court are not legitimate and serious. So if there's a spectrum between Flight 93 and who cares.
Right.
And I'm much more in the spectrum that says these things really matter, especially when you're talking about fundamental constitutional liberties. Mm-hmm. These really matter.
And so something like the Masterpiece Cake Shop. Ruling a case where, you know, this is where a baker was forced essentially to, or it was punished for not baking a cake for a gay marriage.
Right.
You know, that for you, that is a Flight 93 type of question.
No, it's not Flight 93.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. I don't mean it in that sense, but that it's a very serious, important
issue. It's a serious
issue.
Case because it involves, and it was not just baking a cake, not custom designing a cake, because he offered cakes he'd already baked.
Right.
And because this is a issue about compelled speech, in my view, which is a very serious constitutional value. Mm-hmm. So a loss in Master Repeat Cake Shop isn't the end of the First Amendment.
Right.
It's an erosion of the First Amendment. So I think here's the problem. So you have people who really care about specific issues. You have a larger general public that is, let's be honest about it, not that engaged, just not that engaged. But you have to mobilize these people to come to the polls for you. And that's led to a nonstop cycle of exaggeration and hyperbole. And so we have been telling people as a means of sort of whipping them to the polls. It's sort of like, you know, the last bit of the Kentucky Derby. You're just whipping people to the polls, and you just constantly elevate the stakes of everything. And so everything becomes an emergency.
Right.
What? The First Amendment may end, you know? And so, but then there are serious things that occur that provide each side with ammunition.
Right.
So when Obama's Solicitor General was asked during the Obergefell oral argument, what would constitutional recognition of same-sex marriage do for, example, the tax exemption of religious universities, his answer should have been nothing. It's irrelevant to that. Instead, he said, you know, we'll have to see. Well, you know, that's the response that launched a million fundraising letters.
Right.
And so this cycle occurs. There is a serious argument that is then amplified. Serious argument amplified on both sides going back and forth.
What's an example on the left that you see like that, where they take, you know, they take something that may or may not be that big a deal and then amplify it?
So I think one of the things you often see on the left is an exaggeration and amplification of, like, for example, there are hate crimes that occur. There has also been a number that are fake.
Right.
There has been exaggeration in the numbers of hate crimes. Another thing, a perfect example of taking an incident and amplifying it way out of proportion, the Covington Catholic incident. All of a sudden, you know, this 15-year-old kid who's in a very, very, very awkward encounter with a guy who's banging a drum right in front of his face becomes the most punchable face in America.
That must have made Richard Spencer like, whew, I can go on vacation now. I can go out finally. Yeah.
But I will say this. I don't like to brag, but Richard Spencer said on Twitter that I am his reverse moral compass.
Right.
And that I think that's my greatest Twitter moment. But so you take that moment, which it turns out was far more complicated, and you turn it into the symbol of, you know, the oppression of MAGA America, and right. it was hysterical and ridiculous.
It is, in a way, and this conversation for me, it's reminding me of, there was a time where Nathaniel Hawthorne, of all people, he attacked the damned mob of scribbling women because he was toiling anonymously, writing for The Atlantic and Harper's and whatnot, and the most popular stories were written by women, and he was like, and everybody, and of course women at the time were like, you know, we can't even vote, we're going to Seneca Falls to have some kind of representation. And America seems to be now, 21st century America, seems to be a country where everybody feels like they have no rights that no one else dare respect or need respect. It's a bizarre place to be.
I read this op-ed in the New York Times by one of their contributors mm-hmm. who lives in Nashville, not too far from where I live. And it was after Georgia, other states had passed mm-hmm. heartbeat bills. So she's in Tennessee, which has not passed a heartbeat bill. It's passed a trigger bill, something very different. And she's writing an op-ed, and she's saying, I'm not quite saying it's the worst time to live in the South.
Right.
And I'm thinking, okay, we're not even in the same conversation on that point. And yet there's this desire to connect. There's always a desire to connect what's happening right now to the worst incidents of the American past. And I get it, because if you have a proportionate view, nobody pays attention.
Yeah.
And so if you have to elevate it to get people to pay attention, and then people get kind of high on their own supply, so to speak.
Right.
And they start believing.
Which, by the way, was the title of I'm sure you've read it in The Hill. Somebody wrote a thing, David French got high on his own supply. And I read it and I was like, I don't even know what he was referring to.
I have no idea.
So, it's interesting to me, and it actually makes me feel positive to talk with you and understand, I think, like on a basic framework, there's a huge amount of overlap between your vision of kind of constitutional conservatism and my understanding of libertarianism, mm-hmm. that there's, there are certain rules of the game, and now we're going into the octagon, and then we're going to fight on specific issues, and there's a referee, and we agree to live by the rules. The fish rots from the head, because one of the great ironies of the 2016 election is that Trump refused to say he would abide by the election unless he won. And Hillary said that shows he's not fit for office. And then afterwards, he didn't actually accept the election results, because he was like, there was so much fraud, I want a bigger vote count. And Hillary still hasn't really conceded. So it's like we're in this bizarre world. But to talk about kind of specific things, like, have Christians kind of lost the culture wars again and again and again on specific topics? You mentioned abortion. It's interesting to me. I'm actually uncomfortable with a lot of the legal restrictions and mm-hmm. also the hypocrisy of say conservatives using business regulation to say, to kind of limit abortion clinics in Texas or in Virginia, where they've tried to say, well, you need this, you need to be more heavily regulated, because typically, if it's a muffler shop, they don't want any regulation. Mm-hmm. If it's an abortion clinic, they want more regulation than liberals want on muffler shops, et cetera.
Right.
But all of that kind of stuff, but things like gay marriage, drug legalization, feminism, immigration in many ways, they've lost. Abortion seems to be winning, less so, I would say, in a legal way, and more in that there are fewer and fewer abortions, right? So something is working.
Yeah. So there's two things that are happening simultaneously in the abortion realm. One is, and lest everyone fall into this ridiculous, ridiculous MAGA trap of saying we didn't win anything before Donald Trump.
Right.
In the last 5 years of Obama's term, 8 years in office, there were more pro-life laws passed at a faster rate than any time since Roe. That's when conservatives knew nothing but losing.
Right.
And so at the same time, the abortion rate, which had peaked early in the Reagan era, was continuing its rather steep decline. So right now we are at a point where the abortion rate, and this is according to Guttmacher, is lower than it was when Roe was decided.
Right. Yeah.
That is a tremendous – now, there are many reasons for that, many reasons for that.
And including, I mean, to be fair, part of it is the certainly contraception and probably the reduction in the number of abortion clinics or providers. But it's also true the number of unwanted pregnancies is way down, which is
– Right.
Yeah.
So there's – and more people who have unwanted pregnancies carry the baby to term.
Right.
So there's – it's a multifaceted decline. But it's a – if you're a pro-life American and you're looking at that graph – you're saying that that's yeah. a good thing.
How can I? This is, and I was raised Catholic, so a question is, how much of some of this tension, or is there a subline for you, with you, because as an evangelical Christian, I assume that you are okay with birth control.
Yeah.
In a way that if you're a real hardline Catholic, contraception is a big problem.
Right.
I mean, is this part of the cultural difference within or among different types of conservatives?
Well, when the whole first thing started, if you would have said to me, oh, there's a strong Catholic evangelical conflict here, or a latent Catholic evangelical, I would have said, no, because we, over the last 20 years, Catholics and Protestants have become very comfortable being allied.
That's a tremendous loss for me, by the way, because I grew up in an era when that was, you know, the real enemy were the Protestants, not Jews or Muslims.
Right.
And Muslims didn't even exist, or even secular people. Like, you could work with them, but the evangelicals, you knew they thought you were part of the biggest cult on, you know, on the planet, et cetera.
But I'm now realizing there is a strain of that. Now, that's not inherent. I have many Catholic allies. The co-host of my podcast is a wonderful Catholic conservative named Alexandra De Sanctis. So there's nothing inherent.
Would you pray for his conversion to actual Christianity?
Alexandra.
I'm sorry,
My southern speech always ends up slurring that last bit. But anyway, so we joke about it, but we are, you know, very much aligned on this issue of liberalism versus illiberalism. Yeah. But there, I think there's a couple of things going on. And my colleague, Michael Brendan Dougherty, who's Catholic at National Review, wrote a version of this. And he said, essentially what you have is the Catholic Church in the U.S. is facing losses that the evangelical church is not facing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if you
although the mainline Protestant denominations
are not
evangelical.
Not evangelical.
Yeah. Not real Christian.
Yeah. I'm not saying that.
Yeah, I'm projecting.
So the evangelical church in raw numbers continues to grow.
Right.
So if you're a part of a church that is facing real losses and you're in a part of the country, say riding from Manhattan, in which, if you're going to say, is cultural conservatism on the wane or ascendant, it's much more on the wane, then that has an effect on it. I think there are effects that has on a person's outlook on life, as opposed to if you are living part of a church that is growing in a part of the country in which a lot of these cultural issues are going your way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big country. It's not all of the things are happening in the same places in the same way. And so I'm a fan of this old saying, where you stand is often based on where you sit.
Mm.
And the conditions immediately around you can't help but strongly impact the way you look at the world. And so I have a lot of compassion for people who are in communities where they feel increasingly isolated and battled. Maybe they attend a parish that is shrinking, and you're in that situation. And I can understand the psychological impact that it has. I don't think that we then go to Flight 93.
Right.
But I can understand a greater sense of alarm.
Well, you know, to switch to a slightly different but related topic of places where things seem to be going well for a kind of pluralistic libertarian understanding, let's talk about that decision, the recent decision against Oberlin College, Oberlin College, but where a couple of years ago, a local bakery thought a couple of Oberlin students were shoplifting, and it turned out that they were.
Mm-hmm.
And then students at the school, including university officials, started really libeling, defaming, getting in the way of this bakery to do business. It's a longstanding, I think it's like 100 years old or something like that. The case finally came to a verdict, and Oberlin is on the hook for at least $11 million in basic charges or basic
compensatory
fines.
Damages.
And then it may be, I mean, I guess there was an extra $33 million,
which will probably get reduced.
But I mean, this is a huge fine against Oberlin College for acting an ass in things. And you've written that this may be a turning point for kind of campus speech wars. In what way?
Well, not just campus speech wars, but sort of the outrage mob in general. And so what a lot of people forget, because these are matters of state law and few people pay attention to state law, it's state common law, which few people know even what that is that for a long time in this country, throughout the history of this country, the constitutional law and the common law have existed side by side.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, if you're a private citizen, there are an array of common law doctrines that provide you with some basic protection and allow you to kind of be left alone in your life and in your business relationships, to be protected from malicious misconduct directed against you in this sort of sphere of your life, private life. So that means defamation, saying mm-hmm. false things about you. There's a much lower threshold of or burden of proof to prove defamation mm-hmm. than if you're a public figure.
Right.
There's something called intentional interference in contractual relations. If you and I have a contract and one of, you know, your colleagues decides to disrupt that contractual relationship, or we have a business relationship, mm-hmm. maybe that it doesn't even rise to the level of a written contract. There's actually some protections mm-hmm. against third-party interference. Same thing with the concept called intentional infliction of emotional distress. I'm limited in the way that I can try to harm you as a human being, to inflict emotional pain on you. And all of these things are much more sort of magnified when you're a regular private
right.
citizen. Well, one of the negative aspects of modern outrage culture, it's not just that famous people like Hollywood directors get caught up in it.
Right.
Or that, you know, writers like you and I get caught up in it. It's painful when we do, but it's not just that. It's the just an average person going about their business can be caught up in this wave. And often it includes elements that violate these common law torts. There hasn't been a plaintiff's bar that's been alert to this before. There hasn't been a lot of literature on this before. But what happened with Oberlin is you had a particular set of facts that are egregious but not unique. Mm-hmm. You had plaintiff's lawyer, a family committed to vindicating their good name, and you had plaintiff's lawyers dedicated to helping them. And, you know, you put that all together, and you have essentially a model.
So what in particular, what were the statements that the Oberlin students and then some, I guess, some administrators and stuff joined in that were particularly harsh?
So there are a couple of elements here that distinguish this from just statements of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So they did call the bakery racist, mm-hmm. Which is a statement of opinion, but there are certain narrow circumstances in which if that implies certain facts that
right.
don't exist, that can be defamatory,
right.
but they went beyond
and
that.
And they were saying, because the students who were accused of shoplifting, like a few bottles of wine were black.
Two of the three involved were black.
Yeah, and so that was part of the attack on the bakery.
Right. But then they went beyond that. They said that there was a history of racial profiling. Mm-hmm. That is an assertion of fact mm-hmm. that can be disproved. There was no history of racial mm-hmm. profiling. They said that one of the employees was guilty of assault. Again, that's under Ohio law, if you accuse someone of a crime, that's an assertion of mm-hmm. fact, and it's actually libelous per mm-hmm. se. And so they made factual statements that were incorrect. And then, now they didn't sue the students here. They mm-hmm. went for the administrators.
Right.
And the administrators not only sort of provided the students university resources mm-hmm. to you know, print the flyers mm-hmm. and all that. That wouldn't be as big a deal. But there was a dean that was handing out the flyer,
yeah.
including to the media. And now, you know, and it's funny, a lot of these cases turn on these very, you know, small factual disputes mm-hmm. that can make a university look good or bad.
Right.
And they caught her shifting her story on that multiple times. And then there were a lot of communication. So you have this, what is it that takes something and turns it into a punitive damage award? It's like evidence of hatred and malice.
Right.
And so you have the actual dissemination of defamatory statements. You have all of these, communications internally basically saying, you know, F them, you know,
you're
about
right,
this
right.
bakery. And so it really was a circumstance where the university participated in the spreading of false information.
Right.
And that's what elevated this.
Now, an interesting kind of side conversation about this from I don't want to say from a libertarian point of view, but kind of from a First Amendment point of view mm-hmm. is that, and actually now I will say I know a lot of libertarians who don't believe that there should be libel laws. There don't, mm-hmm. shouldn't be defamation laws, or in a more mild form that, you know, it gets worrisome when people expressing opinions, even if they're vile and unfounded and kind of insane or conspiracist or whatever, when you start, you know, bringing charges against people. Do you worry at all about that? You know, that, yes, these are common law torts, so it's going through that system, but the end effect is to limit expression.
So the short answer is yes.
Yeah.
There is an inherent risk in incentivizing. So deep-pocketed litigants have have used in the past frivolous defamation suits mm-hmm. to try to cow people into silence. So the legal framework that I like is a legal framework that is the existing sort of sliding scale of burden of proof. So as I would be considered a public figure in defamation right. law. So I would have to prove actual malice
right.
if I was going to sue you for defamation. I think that's proper. But I also support something called a anti-slap law.
Right.
So these vexatious defamation suits are called slap suits, strategic mm-hmm. lawsuits against public participation. So a lot of states, California being one of them.
They have a very good anti-slap.
Exactly. They allow for a summary proceeding that allows me to rebut the case at a preliminary stage mm-hmm. and recover attorney's fees.
Right.
So I've actually used a slap law in a previous case several years ago, an anti-slap law
right.
to protect free speech. So I think a common law free speech framework mm-hmm. with New York Times v. Sullivan mm-hmm. at the apex combined with anti-slap laws provides the necessary protection. But the fact that the key issue here for me is if you're a private citizen minding your own business, your sort of right to be left alone is at its apex.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, you know, one of my long, you know, a principle I've heard many libertarians mm-hmm. say is my sort of rights end at the end of my nose.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And an originalist who looks at the First Amendment asks what is meant by the phrase the freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
And defamation has never been really considered part of right. the freedom of speech.
I would like to talk with you, and I might have to start a different conversation for a different podcast about foreign policy, because this is a big issue where I think there's a lot of differences of opinion. But in the interest of time, let me close things out by asking to go back to that question mm-hmm. of kind of the liberal right and the liberal left, and I would throw in there the liberal libertarian side, which I think is most people. Libertarians are oddly, I don't want to say we're bystanders in this, but most libertarians I know stand for, you know, really strongly for the idea of having a public square of debate. You know, that is most, you know, it's not about coercion and it's not about threatening people with new laws that are going to restrict how you can live and things like that. But what are some of the strategies where we all, regardless of our ideological kind of flavorings, agree on a kind of liberal understanding of discourse and debate? Because, you know, we're in this world now where, first off, everything is polarized, but also we have more means ever of actually getting our arguments out and interacting with each other. It seems like it should be easier than it is, and it seems to be getting tougher and tougher to have good conversations.
You know, I feel I have found I've had a lot of success in the last few years, especially since the rise of Trump, in looking at folks who are libertarians, liberal left, liberal right, and saying, we can circle the wagons around the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
The Bill of Rights is under attack in multiple different kinds of ways, not just legally, but also culturally. Sort of a culture that despises due process mm-hmm. is dangerous. A culture that despises free speech
right.
is dangerous.
And it's not simply due process. It's in a sense that, and Trump does this a lot and other people do, of like just saying, well, we know what the outcome is going to be, so let's not go through the checklist or the guideline or the legislative, the niceties. We're just going
right.
to make the deal now.
That's
very corrosive.
So I'd say let's circle the wagons around the Bill of Rights and the constitutional structure of mm-hmm. government. No imperial executive.
Mm-hmm.
Revitalize Congress. But then from within that framework, we're going to have a lot of policy disagreement. So a person who's on the liberal left is going to be a lot more open to technocratic government solutions mm-hmm. than I am. I'm reflexively very suspicious of this notion mm-hmm. of government expertise being something that's going to revitalize the American free market.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think there's a ton of evidence
right.
for that position. So we're going to have a lot of policy disagreements short of, you know, once you sort of say, I'm circling the wagons around the Constitution, and let's have at that.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be serious and they can be sometimes acrimonious, you know, fine. But let's at least circle the wagons around this basic constitutional structure of government. And then what the liberal left and the liberal right are saying is, no, the outcome matters more than anything,
mm-hmm.
more than anything. And so we're going to cast aside whatever constitutional structure, whatever provision of the Bill of mm-hmm. Rights stands in our way. I mean, one of the worst things that the liberal left has done in the last decade is the prevalence or the shedding of due process on campus in
mm-hmm.
Title IX in sexual assault and
right.
sexual harassment cases. I mean, this has been a massive injustice across the United States. And many people who have actually risen to oppose that have been on the liberal left.
Right.
Harvard law professors who would have, you know, back when I was there in the early 90s, I never would have thought I'd see massive letter writing campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, literally, a huge chunk of the faculty at the law school wrote a letter saying that they needed better due process for people accused of sexual assault or whatever.
Exactly. So there is within sort of both sides of the spectrum, there's sort of these antibodies that are building against the virus of illiberalism.
In that sense, do you think Trump is Trump a new direction for kind of American political discourse, maybe not ideology per se, but kind of political discourse, or is he a one-off? And when he goes away, whether it's in 2020 or in 2024, more things will become possible, or is... Yeah, I mean, because he's also clearly the effect as much as the cause of anything.
Yeah, I think he's much more of a symptom than a cause. You could look at the negative polarization trends as very clear before 2016, before he came down the escalator. But he's a symptom.
You know, part of me wishes that escalator never arrived.
But, that he's still stuck there. Yeah. But I would say he's a symptom that makes the disease worse. It's like how a hacking cough can break your rib.
Right.
So he's a symptom that makes everything worse. And there's no sort of going back to as if he never existed. But, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in 2020, because if you asked a Democrat in January 1981, after Ronald Reagan is being sworn in, would you say, is Carterism the wave of the future? They would have said, no, don't get his name out of your mouth.
Right.
One-term presidents do not tend to be celebrated by American political parties. Two-term presidents, in absence of things like a major recession or a war that grinds on and on, tend to be seen as models.
Right.
And so the future of the GOP depends an awful lot on what happens in 2020 and whether Trump is sort of seen as an aberration, a product of running against the second most disliked person in the history of favorability polling, or he's, manifestation of a broader wave is to be determined, in my view.
Who do you figure you'll vote for in 2020? Is there a possibility you would vote for Trump?
No. Let me put it this way. I've said it this way. If there was evidence that Trump's character has reformed or reformed fundamentally, I'd be open to it, because I have my view on voting for politicians is I want to vote for somebody who has character that fits the office and exhibits and advances the political values that I share. Both of them are non-negotiable. I will not vote for somebody who does not have at least the basic character to fit the office. And if somebody is of good character, but they don't advance my political values, I won't vote for them.
So unless, I forget what's the name of the treatment that Alex goes through in Clockwork Orange, unless Trump gets that treatment, it seems like you're not going to be voting
for
Trump.
I'm not holding
my
breath.
Okay.
The only person I've said I would vote for is, I tweeted sometime ago.
Obviously Evan McMullen and yourself, right?
If I'd run, I would have voted for myself. No. The only person in the 2020 conversation I said I would vote for is if Justin Amash ran for the Libertarian nomination and ran as a Libertarian.
Oh, and that may happen. Yeah, he certainly fits your twofold test. Is there anybody on the Democratic side that you think comes close to somebody that you could vote for?
This is where this is going to be a difference between you and I, pretty profound difference. I've never voted for a pro-choice politician. Okay. And when Joe Biden said he was going to try to repeal the Hyde Amendment or did not support the Hyde Amendment, to me that was a symbol of how completely the Democratic Party has moved to the left on that issue. And there's absolutely no way I could ever vote for somebody in particular who would say that we have to have public funding of abortions.
And Biden, of course, is interesting because he's very Catholic and says personally, and I guess there's a whole history of Catholic candidates or Catholic politicians who say they're against abortion, but they're in favor of either public funding or remaining the status quo.
Right.
That's an interesting kind of conundrum for that.
Right. I mean, the two parties are polarizing very much around that issue.
And because there are also no pro-choice Republicans.
William Weld.
Yeah, that's true.
Weld. I mean, there are pro-choice Republicans who run and win in blue states.
Right.
But nationally, there's no such thing as a viable pro-choice right. Republican nominee for president.
Yeah, that's fascinating. All right, well, we're going to leave it there. This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie, and I've been talking to David French of National Review and of Time. David, thanks so much for talking.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening. Please subscribe to us at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Google, at Apple, and iTunes, and, of course, Reason.com. Thanks so much.